Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Markham Pfeiffer. Markham Pfeiffer is a United States Air Force veteran, author, and emotional leadership strategist who brings a grounded, authentic voice to conversations about life after service. Markham enlisted at 17 and served as a senior airman before transitioning into leadership roles supporting military members as Director of Education Services for the Ohio National Guard. His work involved managing crisis response, GI Bill access, and suicide prevention, giving him firsthand insight into the emotional burdens many veterans face. Today, Markham speaks openly about PTSD, identity loss, and rebuilding after military life. He's the creator of the Core Alignment Index and author of Navigating Leadership, From Toxicity to Triumph. Markham, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the program today.
Thanks for the invite, and I look forward to this amazing discussion we're about to have.
I am looking forward to, and before we begin, I want to thank you on behalf of my family for yours, and I know you have a longstanding history of your family members being in the service. I want to thank you and your family for your service, for whatever you've done to keep us safe, to keep us secure, and for giving a little bit of yourself to the greater good. So on behalf of me and my family, my thanks to you and your family.
You're very welcome.
So my first question for you today is, tell our audience about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions today.
I'd say that being in boot camp at 17 holds a strong foundation of who you become later on in life, right? When you're doing the core values of the service before self, integrity before, integrity first, service before self, excellence in everything we do. That's held true in everything I've tried to do since then. So that's the core foundation, because essentially when my dad used to say all the time, like, oh, you have to have integrity, you have to have integrity. And I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. And then when it was beating in my head in boot camp, I'm like, oh yeah, I have to have integrity and I have to do things the right way. Right. So that there's been a lot of paths to where I currently sit, a lot of mistakes made along the way, but it's still the foundation of those core values that's still hold true to this day.
Yeah, I think those core values can serve us in anything. One of my good friends who was in the military, he was a chief petty officer, senior chief petty officer of the United States Navy, and he told me the difference between being simply good and being outstanding was attention to detail, and that goes back to all those core values of leadership, of excellence, and I always carried that with me. It's something that I impart to my students, particularly because, and I tell them, it doesn't take much more time to pay attention to detail than it does not to.
Yeah, often the details do add up, right? Like you're matching puzzle pieces there. But if you don't correctly pay attention to that, then you end up missing the piece, right? So my dad always says, and this is a great thing that I've said 1,000 times, is that my dad always says that once you've reached the point of clarity, true clarity, then you start to see the signs that are always in front of you, yeah. Right? So that's the attention to detail that everyone's trying to find. And then if you correctly are doing it, then you're realizing that you've aligned yourself with the path you were supposed to be on.
I've had good friends that have been in the military, and they tell me that attention to detail not only keeps them safe, but it keeps their platoon safe, their company safe. So everything that they do for themselves has an impact on everybody that they're responsible for. Their brothers.
Absolutely. Yes. It's the old adage of, if you're not packing your parachute the right way, right?
Yep.
There's the person that's assigned that. If they're not taking their job seriously, who are you affecting?
Yeah.
Right. So it all adds up to everyone has a place in this, what they're trying to do. And it adds up to the bigger picture of we're all here to help each other out.
Absolutely. When we were talking during our pre-chat, I was thinking there's so many areas I could go with it because there's so many topics of expertise that you have as it relates to veterans. But one of the things that I really wanted to get into is parenting after service, the issues with divorce in the military after service. So I wanted to get into primarily that today with you. I'm sure there'll be some other related topics that'll come out of our discussion. But in that vein, what are the challenges that veterans face when returning to their roles as parents after service? And my second part of that question is, as coaches and clinicians, how can we best help them return to that role effectively?
Yeah, the military is a weird thing. There's a level of camaraderie that you can't replace, essentially, and people try many years to replace that. It's similar to, if you played college football, right? You're there 4 or 5 years with the same people over and over, classes and hanging out. It's similar to that, but not really, because you're moving around every 3 to 5 years of your active duty, right? And you're seeing new people and you're making new friends, but essentially you're in this bubble. And the only people that get it are the people that are also in the bubble with you. So the people that have deployed multiple times over the last 20 plus years, right? They come back and they expect things to be the same because life goes on without them while they're gone, right? So when they try to transition out and get everything back to a framework of normalcy, they realize they have to do something completely different and figure out where they're at that moment, right? So yeah, military have a significantly higher divorce rate than most other professions because of this, right? You're in a place that you have to be because you signed the contract. Can't just say, I quit, I'm done with this, right? You often go to places that you don't want to be. The Air Force bases in Iceland, right? In Greenland and all over the place, right? So it's like, okay, I don't want to be here, but I still have to do my job. But then you're also moving, if you're married, have a spouse or kids, they're also moving with you on this journey. So every 3 to 5 years, they're in a new spot, school district, new friends, that kind of thing. So it only adds to the heightened stress level of being in the military. Coupled with the fact that if you're in your first 1 to 5 years of military service, you're not making much money. So the financial stress of that adds to, you know, what is the one or two top things that the people can get divorced for is finances. Yep. So you're adding finances to moving around constantly to the stress of, hey, like a friend of mine's son is doing some specialty work in some of the Asian countries, because that's where we're taking the fight to, right? So that's adding to the stress of like, hey, this is, I got to see things differently. I got to make sure I'm focused on what I'm trying to do.
Finances and children are the two biggest things I think that my wife and I used to argue about, and we used to have stressors over. But I think when you mentioned the finances, it also coupled with the moves. And my understanding, Markham, if I'm correct, that military promotion is also based on the person's willingness to be mobile and to move, and a lot of times they have to move to get that promotion?
Yes, and also it's based on several things. What's your specialization? What is the need? You're always going off of what the need is of the Department of Defense. That's where you're going to go, right? So you can say, sometimes you can put paperwork in and say, no, I'm going to stay right here for another 4 years, and they're like, okay, cool, so for 4 years, you're not going to get promoted. So that's a toss-up you have to think about, right?
Yeah.
I like being here. I like the community. I don't want to move, but I'm also pushing back my promotion potentially by 3 to 4 years. So it all depends on the specialization and what specifically they're doing. You're going to get promoted quicker for something, say, in the Air Force, if you're a PJ, a pararescueman, because you're constantly in danger. There's a need for it. There's a very small percentage of the Air Force that actually does that job. You're going to get promoted quicker. If you're some admin person, you know, it might slow down that process. So the other part of your question was that, how do we deal with that as coaches and facilitators? Is that if you're specifically working with veterans, you have to understand all the things, the nuances that go into that, right? The way they're talked to, often leadership is antiquated. It's really old school, right? It's like, I'm going to scream at you. Don't ask questions. And then again, because in the real world, you can quit. You're not going to talk to me like that again. I'm quitting. The military, you sign a contract. You have to do the entire contract, right? So understanding that there's a lot of added pressure to being in the military, a lot of added pressure to how do you explain to the rest of the world what you did in the military and explain in layman's terms when you're trying to find a civilian job, which often happens, right? So they have you know, a transition assistance program, which is called TAP, that they help people getting out or retiring. And they try to explain, okay, these are civilian jobs. These are interview skills. These are resumes and that kind of stuff. But often that doesn't translate over. And so what often happens is that, okay, so you're so used to putting on a uniform and everyone's showing up on time for the most part, right? Everyone doing their job to the best of their ability. And then you go show up at a civilian job, people are coming and going as they please, and they don't have routine and discipline, and there's like that kind of stuff. So then you don't know where you fit. And then it leads to a level of like imposter syndrome. You know, like, am I really supposed to be here? How do I find, this is often what happens is people try the civilian world and then they end up back in the federal job because that's the closest they can get to what they had in the military. Right. So it's understanding all those things together. And there's also a significantly higher suicide rate in the military, significantly higher divorce rate, all those things, domestic violence. These are all things, alcoholism, drug use. These are all related to being in the military. I'd say it's almost similar to like what happens on the Indian reservations. Very similar. Significant alcoholism, divorce rate, all that stuff, right? Because they're often not provided the right resources either. So you can go to the VA and maybe they'll see you in 5 weeks, 6 weeks, 3 months from now, right? And then they'll throw a bunch of stuff at you and you're like, that doesn't work. And you're actually just affecting my ability to actually be around people because now I'm just numb to the world, right? So now there are practitioners that take this job very serious. My cousin, for one of them, is a psychologist with the VA, specializing in veterans with PTSD. Right. So there are plenty of them that take this very serious, but also VA is the VA. It's a broken system. Right. So there's a saying that, especially with the Marines, that we teach them how to kill and then we throw away the key to how to turn it off. Right. So you come back to the real world and you're like, oh, this isn't it. Right. I don't have a heightened sense of awareness. Right. My fight or flight, I have to turn down. I have to be normal to the rest of the world. But how do I do that? How do I say, so my friends of mine and family of mine that's been deployed multiple times, how do you come back after like, okay, I had a friend of mine, a Marine friend of mine, he's retired now. He deployed 10 times. Wow. How do you explain to your kids and your family, this is what I did for almost 10 years of my life? And a heightened sense of violence around me and trying to do the mission and like creating a hyper bubble of PTSD, right? And my end goal always is to come home and make sure the people on my left and right are coming home as well.
Yeah. And it's like, how do you explain to your family that this is what I did for two or three terms? How do I explain that? Would they even understand that? What I had to do?
No, both wouldn't. That's like the people that came back from World War II. So we're deployed for are the longest we've ever been in our country's history, right? So we're deployed for, you started World War II and you ended up surviving somehow towards the end of the war. You're there for 6-7 years, right? So then we told them, come back, shut your mouth and go back to work.
Yeah.
Right? So the HBO did a phenomenal documentary a few years ago about PTSD and what that means. And they talked to some of the World War II people and they said, yeah, when my wife or kids would go hang out with their friends or get outside the house, I'd go to my closet and cry myself to sleep because I couldn't handle the remnants of what the things I did and the things I saw.
Yeah. I imagine, well, I'm going to ask you this question. Is another source of stress in a marriage for a veteran and their spouse is if the spouse wants to know, I'm your wife here to listen. I want you to tell me what happened over there. And then veteran doesn't want to talk about it. Is that also another source of stress or misunderstanding in the marriage as well, too?
100%, because I think it goes toward the military and first responders, both, right? So my ex-wife is an ER doctor, and she's been so for 15 years. So when we were married, she would come home, not want to talk about the stuff that she saw. Right. So I'm the person, I'm not the ER doctor. I'm trying to be supportive, but I don't know how to be because she doesn't know how to talk about what she saw in the ER. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a similar concept. Or my friends that are cops, like they go on the beat and they're being shot at. How do you explain that? It's very similar to, I think part of it is we haven't been taught or we don't listen to what a great coping mechanism would actually do in our life, mm-hmm. or a great outlet would actually do in our life. We haven't surrounded ourselves in a place where we can actually be comfortable enough to actually talk about these things that have happened, right? So while, you know, you and I talk, while I'm at PTSD, I have PTSD from car accidents and I have workplace PTSD as well. I can speak from that level of it, the things that I've seen from that, but I can't speak to, for instance, the combat veterans that have been out there and some of the amazingly crazy things that I've heard from friends of mine that were doing in Iraq, Afghanistan, and around the world. Yeah. Right. But I think it's people having the ability to understand, you're not understanding where I'm coming from. Maybe we need to add a third party to this. Maybe we need to add counseling to this, consistently counseling, and just allowing ourselves the space to speak on what our perspective is and what our point of view is.
So in summary, or what have you seen has been the factors that do contribute to veterans and their spouses divorcing? And how does it differ from the factors contributing to divorce, or how is it similar to divorce in non-service households?
I think that the added expectation and the added stressors of what it means to be in the military, especially active duty, depending on your job, but also it's almost like a bubble when you're on a base. They're in the middle of nowhere and they're in really tiny cities, right? And you're it. So you're forced to be in that environment. The same things are divorce and financial issues and the kids. Those are still the main stressors, right? I think there's more so heightened when you're active duty.
You know, the other thing I was thinking when you were mentioning about the frequent moves that typically characterize military families, kids who have just made connections with their friends and established a sense of community, and they have to leave all over again. I imagine that's also got to be a stressor for them as well, that impacts the entire family unit.
100%. I have a friend, when I was active duty, she was there at the base I was at the civilian, and then she ended up marrying someone that became an Army officer. Their kids, for the most part, grew up overseas, right? So they spent 5 years in Oman, and they spent the last 3 years in Italy, right? So it's a weird two different traditions and cultures and what's happening outside of your house, right? How do you adjust? I also found that military brats are way more adjustable to differences in environments, and they're way easier to make friends a lot quicker, right? So, well, on one hand, it's a stressor because I grew up not a military style, but you essentially call my dad a full-time pastor for our church for several years growing up and up until about sixth grade. So we moved around every 2 years. I lived in like seven different states growing up. So it's very similar, right? Mm-hmm. So now I'm to the point of with the saying, I've never met a stranger, right? So I can go in any environment and talk my way into it and find my in and have a whole conversation. But it's a same thing with the military kids for sure.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing, they become adaptable pretty quickly.
Their ability to meld into the environment is a lot better than most people. So it's like the people that never left their town. If you're bringing them into an environment that's completely not normal to what they're used to, mm-hmm. and they don't know how to react and they want to get out of that environment. A lot of the military kids are so used to moving around that they adjust really quick.
Yeah, and we can learn a lot about adaptability and adjusting just from, as you mentioned, military kids in the military. So anyway, identity shifts was another thing that we talked about, I think, during our conversation. What are some identity shifts that are most common with veterans after service that they have to negotiate? And what do we need to do as coaches and clinicians in order to understand and help them best navigate those shifts?
For a veteran, especially ones transitioning out, is who am I now? If I don't have this thing that's been a constant in my life, who am I now? Right? So it's meeting them where they're at and asking the right open-ended questions to get them to the point of like, okay, this was your identity at that point. Where do you want it to go from this point? Right. And I had a friend of mine, he did 21 years in the Air Force. Right. And what happened is that he retired. 2 years into being retired, all the stuff that he had been ignoring in his PTSD and those kind of things all hit him at the same point. To the point of like, he was on the verge of getting divorced and all the stuff that happened with that. Right. And they realize that who am I is the question discussed multiple times. Who am I if I don't have this routine, if I don't have this set discipline, if I don't have this set expectation of make sure my uniform's ironed, right? That I'm shaved, that all the stuff that happens with that, right? And so he had to get to the point of like, okay, I need to go talk to somebody about this. So now he does that consistently, right? But also it's, who do I want to become from this point forward?
Yeah.
It's a better question for most people, right? And that's the kind of work that I'm trying to do with the people that I help is who do I want to become from this point forward?
Yeah. And I think civilian, service individuals, we do go through identity shifts, maybe for different reasons, but I've asked myself at numerous points in my life, Markham, who am I and what kind of a world do I want to live in? And those questions always beg itself whenever there's a challenge that I'm facing that requires me to take a look at who I am now and who do I want to be in the future.
I always say, I've said that through multiple life events, going through a divorce with kids. It's, how did I get here?
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't the plan. Who am I today? If that's not the plan anymore. Right. So it's taken a lot of work internally to tap into what the invisible scars that I've created for myself and try to knock those away or move those aside to a point where they're actually bearable. Right. But I think that people is that you get so caught up on the day to day of I have to live, I have to take care of my kids, I have to go to work, I have to pay my bills, that you don't stop long enough to realize I'm building this essentially a darkness inside of me, and I don't know how to deal with it correctly.
Yep.
Right. So then you try to heal, but you don't take enough time to actually thoroughly look yourself in the mirror and understand the reflection you see.
Yeah. Because in order for us to begin to determine who we are, we have to sit still with ourselves long enough to figure that out. We have to sit in the quiet and really just kind of figure out, okay, where do we go from here?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's at this point in my life, I would say that in May, I got riffed from my last job, right? So reduction in force. And so I've had to say, wait, how did I get here again?
Yeah.
Why? What's the consistency of the repetition that this keeps happening over and over again? Right. So my dad, he always says, when did you know? That's number one. And number two, why do you keep allowing yourself to take temporary detours instead of saying, this is what I was meant to do, get to that point, right? So that's what I hearken to often is that, yeah, I'm at the point of, I know what I can bring to the table. I know what my voice is. I know how I help people, how I guide people to a certain level, right? I guesstimated the other day, I probably helped in my education world, I've probably helped roughly 5,000 students in my career get to a point that they needed to go to, either whether that be access to college or access to a job on the other end of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You really have to custom how you're talking to that person. You have to understand where they're coming from. You have to get the background story. You have to figure out the biases. What are you bringing to the table? And then create the plan around that.
Yeah, it makes sense. If we establish ourselves as listeners, we can get the full picture of what an individual wants and tailor something that's individualized to them.
100%.
And I think the most important piece of being a good coach, a good clinician, is your ability to use active listening. And I think that's where it all starts.
It's active listening, asking open-ended questions.
Yep.
Don't have a stopping point. Have the next thing set up where you're like, okay, and what else can we do to get you to that point? What are you doing to get yourself to that point, right? And what are the barriers that are either yourself are being put in or the environment around you that's also a barrier? And how can we get past that?
And the open-ended questions allow for an individual story to come out, and it just empowers them to speak about what they feel they need for themselves.
Right. I think if you allow yourself, especially as men, right, there's a whole stigma of like, we're not allowed to talk about our feelings. We're not allowed to be raw and vulnerable. We're not allowed to say that hurts. I'm in pain from that. That this is how that point in my life really affected moving forward. Right. And so I try to allow the people that I talk to the space. Just be okay with whatever that is.
Yep.
Speak from your heart, speak with vulnerability, speak with rawness, and say, I wish this was more of a commonplace. And we're not supposed to be, you know, we have to be masculine and macho and everything that comes with that. And the whole warrior mindset of like, we're going to go take on the world kind of thing. But it's also still okay to go to counseling. That anything's hurt, that say that caused me pain, and that's still is lingering from 20 years ago. Like, it's okay to say that.
Yeah.
And it's okay to be in a space where you're supported and you're not felt like you're, you know, being put in a place of being an outcast. I have really amazing friends, but they're in different tiers of my life, right? Top level, very tiny, very, very tiny, are the people that don't care about the stigma. Just open, we talk about stuff.
Yeah.
Not seeing my kid for 2 weeks, that hurt. My kid not responding within enough time to a text I send them, just checking in. That sucks, right? These are the kind of conversations I had with that few. A lot of it in the middle percentage, probably the 75% level, is so much of it is at a superficial level.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about sports, and we send each other funny memes, and we talk about things that have nothing to do with anything, and that's okay. But I almost wish that a percentage of 80% moved up to the top 1-5%.
Yeah, I think eventually they may. It just might take them a little longer.
Well, I need some of these people to level up, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean,
because what happens is that, you know, you're a little more seasoned in life than I am. Is that once you get to that point, is that you're like, what really matters are relationships.
Mm-hmm.
More so than anything else in life. What matters at the end of the day is how you treat your kids, how you treat your spouse, whoever that may be, how you treat your friends, what kind of person you are, right? And knowing that the people around you truly have your back,
yep,
consistently are supportive of you, consistently are loving you and caring on you, right? And consistently want you to do great with no ill intention.
Yep.
And I think at some point, start filtering those people out that aren't doing that.
Yeah.
Right. And then your core base are those solid people that no matter what happens in your life, they have your back.
Absolutely. And I think as I get older, I tell my students, and I kid around with them, but I tell my black book, it has less pages in it, because the individuals who I weed out, more individuals now as I get older that don't align with my values, or I don't believe have my best intentions at heart, or whose energy I just don't want to be around anymore because it drains me. So the people that I have in my support circle now are those that I truly align with. And I'm fine with just walking away now as I get older from people or other experiences that no longer serve me. And I've got, at this point, nothing to gain by not being vulnerable and sharing my story, sharing what's on my mind. Because if that's going to help somebody else, to me, that's my vulnerability can be a source of somebody else's strength or inspiration, as well as be a source of strength for myself.
100%. And my friends always say that I have a story for everything. I'm like, yeah, because I've lived a long life in my 46 years, sometimes stupidly, sometimes some really not good decision-making, right, that I've done. But I've learned along the way that I can relate to a lot of people because of the life that I've lived.
Mm-hmm.
From moving around a lot, from being in the military, from the different friends I have from around the world. So I get from perspectives, right? Those kind of things. But also, I'm really good at meeting people where they're at. Like, I'm excellent at it, like really good at it. So people feel comfortable around me. And then they tell me their life story, stuff that they haven't told anybody in their life, because I allow them the space to say what they need to say.
Well, and you create a safe space, you create a welcoming space, and you create a space where a rapport can be established. And I think for anybody that's got PTSD, that safety and structure is important. They need to feel safe if they're going to eventually begin to share their innermost thoughts with you, and in the hope and with the help of healing and in navigating the challenges that their PTSD has presented.
100%. And it's as with anything, when it comes to significant life events or stressors, like there's different levels to it. And some of my friends have severe PTSD. Like there's nothing going on in their eyes. They don't show emotion about anything, no matter what it is. My uncle's the same way. He's retired Delta, and he doesn't talk about any of it. He keeps it all inside, right? So I can imagine, like, last time I saw him a long time ago, we're telling jokes, no reaction. Something sad happened, no reaction. It's consistently just a straight face, because he's like, there's so much going on internally, like there's a turmoil of it, that he's trying to get to the point where, like, how do I create a space where I have some level of normalcy?
Yeah.
Where the PTSD doesn't eat me alive, kind of thing, right? I'm still a great grandfather to these kids and present consistently to what they need.
Yep.
Yep. And I always quote consistently, quote Ram Dass, who always talks about be here now, be present, yep, be available, be the comfort that people need in their life consistently.
Yeah.
Right. So at some point I could have had his same hair, but that was so long ago. But up to the point of like, what I really want to do in life is help. Someone asked me, I have a call out for this with someone I'm potentially going to do a dual podcast with. She does breathing techniques and being present, that kind of stuff. And she said, what do you really want to do if you were to do it right now? I said, help people. I want to help people. I don't want to be broke doing it, but I want to be consistently knowing that I've made a difference in someone's life.
Yeah.
That the lasting impression that, you know, might be delayed gratification, and I might even not ever hear about it, but I know that I've done right by them, that I've led with integrity, right? Circling back to that. I've led with the integrity, and I've led with trying to get them to be the best version of themselves.
Yeah, and I think if we can all strive to do that, the world would be a better place.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, you know, it's hard to do with these ever-changing times we're in, politically, AI that's going to take over. My dad sent me an article the other day that this guy that's deep into the AI world, and he essentially said by 2027, AGI will be in full effect, and by 2030, there'll be mass unemployment around the world, right? So not to scare people off, not to say the mushroom-clad cloud is coming, but essentially it is, right? So how are we preparing ourselves, and how are we future-proofing our life, and also being able to adjust and adapt and move forward with the times no matter what?
Yep. And it's important to be able to do that, because the times, they are changing, Markham, you know?
We're on the precipice of a lot of things.
Yep.
I said, you know, potentially we might be World War III in the next 5 years. Who knows, right? But we can't control that. All we can control is ourselves. We can control how we feel about things, how we react to things, how we speak to people, right? How we show up for people. That's what we can control. That's how we can coach people, right? That's how we can establish that foundation of, I would say that what starts with, it should start and end with empathy and compassion, everything you do, right? If friends are very successful, and I'm like, good for you. I champion their cause. I cheer them on. I always talk about how great they are. Well, what makes them great to me is that I can still talk to them as a human being.
Yep.
You're worth millions, but you still treat me cool. Let's talk about stuff we used to do. Let's talk about plans moving forward, right? And that's what I like about it, because often that there's a separator of like, I become successful and I don't want to talk to you anymore. I can't I don't understand where you're coming from, or there's no correlation to my life currently. Right? If you lead with empathy and compassion, you can find a commonality no matter what.
Absolutely. And that leads me to think of another Ram Dass quote, is that we're all just walking each other home. And the way we walk each other home is by fostering a climate of empathy and compassion for one another. That's how I believe that's how we do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've said that forever, and it's taken me a while to actually figure out what that means, right? Leading with empathy and compassion. There's been times I didn't do that. There's been times I made a lot of mistakes and talked to people, was dismissive and condescending and talked down to people. And I realized I can't do that, right? I can't, because essentially I want to scaffold for my kids the right way to treat people.
Yeah.
The right, you know, to model for them how they should be treated if people are talking to them. And for them to understand that if people aren't doing these things, then they need to cut them out, or they need to put up barriers or put up expectations of like, here, boundaries, right? That's not how we're going to talk. That's not how you're going to treat me. That's not how we're doing things moving forward, right? So I try to consistently model my kids and the people around me that this is how I want to be treated, and this is my expectation of how I want you to treat people, especially in my presence.
Yep. Yeah, it makes sense. We are role models for our kids, and particularly when they're younger, they learn through imitation. So if we want to teach them appropriate behavior, we have to model it. It's like, don't ask somebody to do something you wouldn't do yourself.
100%. And it's, I always tell the story of like, it was a time where I was, my kids were going back and forth, and it was early on into my divorce, and my expectation at my place is different than their mom's expectation. Not right or wrong, it's different, right? So almost like they would get dropped off to me on Friday, and now we'd have to, okay, let's re-acclimate yourself to what my rules are here, right? And there was a time where I think my daughter was about 4 or 5, and I was still not reacting correctly to them not acclimating quick enough, right? And I would raise my voice and throw things. And one time I looked over and I saw fear in my daughter's eyes. And I was like, never doing that again. I haven't done it since. Now, am I still firm? Absolutely. Do I go off? No. Sometimes for my 15-year-old, because he needs to realize that I'm still his dad, then he needs to listen. But that's every once a quarter, I might raise my voice and clap my hands and snap, you know, throw some things so he snaps out of him being a teenage boy. For my daughter, I'm like, that's not how we're doing things. And I allow her the space. She's 11. She's going through hormones and everything comes with it. Is I allow her the space. Like, if you're frustrated, 100%, be frustrated. But don't take it out on me or anyone else around you because you're frustrated.
Yeah.
If you need to remove yourself, go back to your room, shut your door, throw your pillows around, have at it. If you want to talk to me calmly about what's going on and I can try to help you get to a point, Tom, we can do that as well.
Well, you know,
hey, don't go off on that person. Don't raise your voice on that person, right?
Yeah.
You're frustrated. How can you express that frustration in a different way?
Absolutely. And how can you take ownership of it in a way that shows that you're accountable? And,
absolutely.
You know, like I can come to you and say, Merk, I'm frustrated because of this situation. Can we talk? Can you help me get through this? Can you help me to just process it? And that's taking ownership of it rather than projecting that frustration onto somebody else, because we don't want to deal with it or we don't want to take ownership of it.
Yeah, and I've gotten better. I'm still learning how to correctly do that. There are times that I don't correctly do it, right? I'm still learning. I'm still getting better at it. I'm still understanding the nuances of that. I recently, 2 days ago, apologized to a friend of mine I hadn't spoken to since December. We found a happy middle ground. We moved on.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't agree with the way he was talking about something. He didn't agree with the way I was talking about something. We both got angry about it and then just stopped talking.
Yeah.
And what I said was, I didn't come across the right way. I apologize. If that pissed you off or made you feel hurt or pain, I apologize. That was never my intention. And we finally, he spoke his piece, I spoke my piece, and we moved on.
Yeah.
Right? But I think what's happened in the past is I used to get really defensive when people call me out on stuff. Because I think in a, from my many years of dealing with people, is there's a right and wrong way to handle that and the right and wrong way to approach that. Mm-hmm. And if you're coming at me immediately with lots of anger and you're talking down to me and that kind of thing, so many people shut that off and immediately get defensive.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I put people in that position and people put me in that position. So now I try to come to the point of, I get that something I did was either wrong or taken in the wrong manner. How can we talk about this openly?
Yeah.
Right. And I've had that happen several times since January, where I'm like, okay, let's talk this out. Let's be adults about this. Let's have cool, calm, collected, respectable dialogue about what's going on. You voice your, you know, apprehension. I'll voice mine. We'll find a middle ground or we won't.
Yeah.
Right. That I think you almost have to create muscle memory of, this is how I'm going to react to things. And consistently, I wrote a book. It's not out yet, but it's called The Unseen. It's consistently about how you look yourself in the mirror. And sometimes you look up and you see a stranger. You don't know who that person is anymore. So that's the point where you need to correctly stop and assess what's actually going on, to the point where you don't really understand or see yourself in the mirror anymore.
Yeah. It's like, why don't you recognize that person in the mirror anymore? What has changed that's caused you to not see what you're seeing in the mirror, you know? And it's, I think, speaks to the point of the need to, like, always self-evaluate. And we're all works in progress anyway. You mentioned, you know, I'm still learning at my age, and I'm 70 years old now. I'm still learning. I still learn from my mistakes. Everything's got something to teach me. And I'm going to keep growing until the day that I start dancing in another dimension. So, and then again, my growth will continue there. So it's just a matter of, yeah, everything that happens to us in this lifetime is information that we can use to better ourselves. So speaking of books.
Yes, sir.
Your book, Navigating Leadership, From Toxicity to Triumph, I believe was published earlier this year. Am I correct?
Yeah, it was published, I believe, in June was when I published it.
So what inspired you to write it? What is it about? And what do you want your readers to take away from it?
What inspired me to write it? I've had a lot of not great leadership throughout my career, who are consistently not understanding how to be modernized, how they lead people. And it's what got to the point of me writing that was, I experienced workplace PTSD when I was working for the Ohio National Guard, right? So a person that was allowed to be in charge, had also been there for 44 years, knew where all the deep, dark secrets were, and she was allowed to do whatever she wanted, right? So at one point I was seeing her head come out of my wall at 2 o'clock in the morning screaming at me. And my eye was twitching for about 7 straight months. I would sit in the parking lot of that the headquarters, which is not that far from me, 20 minutes before I even walked in the door. And I said, like, I decide daily, do I really care about paying my bills anymore? Or should I quit immediately and just go and find something else, right? So that affected the very next position I had, another company, right? So I was overreacting to things. I was still primed for that workplace PTSD. And now it's gotten a lot better. But there's still a level of skepticism and being slightly jaded to, are there actual good leaders out there, right? So that's why I wrote it. Here are the foundational theory pieces of what toxicity is, what leads to burnout, what leads to not taking care of your people correctly, right? And here's a 6 to 9 month plan of how to get that hopefully back to a place of reset and starting fresh. Yeah. But what often happens is that the foundational pieces of leadership have been there so long that no one wants to do anything different. So that same lady told me, I don't know why you bring me new ideas. It's like Groundhog Day here. Nothing ever changes.
And conventional wisdom is highly overrated, Markham.
I know. It is. Well, having common sense and actually being there for your people, understanding where they're coming from. I was sitting here this yesterday, actually, my daughter's softball practice. One of the parents is floor manager of a huge grocery store here in Ohio. And she has like 300 people on her. And she said, you know what I do is that the first hour I walk around and I talk to each and every one of my associates and ask them how they're doing, how their kids are doing, how their pets are doing. What did they do yesterday that was something cool or fun or exciting? And I said, yeah, if you're in a place of leadership and you don't know the people working for you, you don't know their kids' names, that's an issue. If you don't know, like in my case, you don't know that both my kids play travel sports. Like, that's an issue, right? Things I like to do for fun, the things that are either exciting to me, stressors, like someone having, one of the parents is going through divorce or something. I mean, divorce or going through cancer or something, major life event. Yeah. And this is what is in the back of my head as I'm trying to do this job, right? If you don't know these things about your team, then what are you actually doing?
Well, and it's important. I mean, the humanistic approach and supervision needs to be emphasized more. When I was a middle manager supervisor, and I learned from my late mentor and supervisor that know as much as you can to the extent that your team is willing to tell you about their personal lives for a lot of different reasons. One, that gives you a greater sense of connection. But the second thing is that what's going on in our personal lives impacts what's going to happen at work. Because if they're missing work, if they're absent, or if, you know, they're distracted on the job, or they're not getting their assignments in on time, or their treatment plans in on time, something's going on. And if you know that personal information and you know that they're experiencing some stressors at home, you could sit down and develop a plan that's going to help them address the personal stuff and then, you know, make them more or as equally effective as they were prior to those stressors at work. And it's an investment that you make in your people.
That's it. And I think the more modern touch is the more centered version of leadership, right? So you have a little bit of everything mixed in.
Yep.
You know, you're the adaptive leadership piece. Like, I always say that I'm halfway through my doctorate in strategic leadership, right? I can break down theory and foundation and no one cares.
No.
It's how I come to the position of being present to what my team needs.
Yeah.
Or if I'm coaching somebody, what they actually need, right? That's more so what people care about than anything else, right? I know this all day long. I can write a 50-page paper on this all day long. No one cares. Nobody cares, right? It's consistently how I'm treating you, consistently how I'm showing up, consistently what is the level of presence that I'm there for you, right? So that all goes to the piece about this, the navigating leadership is, how do you correctly navigate that, right? So what are the things that are in place? Is that how many of your people have reached the point of being burned out and you're not paying attention to that?
Yeah.
What's not going to fix that is a pizza party on Friday. That's not going to fix it, right? Giving them more added responsibility of two or three people and not getting them any help, that's not going to fix it. Not giving them promotions, not giving them more money, that's not going to fix it, right? Or on the other side of that, which is promising people things and never following through.
Yeah.
If you do these things, my brother experienced this several times. If you do these things, we will make you GM or we will make you director of operations. And then she does those things and that never comes to fruition. Right. That just makes you want to go somewhere else. So how am I being treated with respect, with understanding where I'm coming from, with understanding what my needs are? Right. But if you can, there's someone said, had it hit pause on promoting my people because we were trying to find the money to do so. I called a meeting for my people and told them that straight up. This will happen in a little bit. And then followed up 6 months later and gave everybody more money. Right. But the transparency of it has to happen.
Yeah,
and consistently the transparency has to happen where this is what's actually going on. I'm not going to keep you in the blind. I'm not going to lie or stretch the truth. I'm going to tell you exactly what's going on. This might affect some of your jobs because budgets have been cut. Funding's not there anymore. Or, you know, we have to go in a different direction with things. And not blindsiding people with these facts after the point.
Yeah.
Right? It's treat me with respect. Give me enough heads up where I can plan it correctly for my life. Yeah. So I've been blindsided several times in my career where I'm like, if you just told me, hey, in 3 months, we won't have funding anymore, I can plan it correctly. I can go update my resume. I can update my LinkedIn. I can reach out to my contacts and figure out what's out there right now, right? As opposed to you telling me the day before and all of a sudden now I'm stuck with what?
It's be responsive to your staff's needs. Be transparent. Let me know what's coming so I can plan. Even if the news is bad, let me know.
Absolutely.
Let me know.
Yeah, and I had a place treat me like I got blindsided. They shifted funding for my salary to a brand new person that they were bringing on board. But the way I was treated was like, it's worked you for the past year. I grew our program by 50%. I did this, that, and the other, right? You're treating me like I stole office equipment from you. Like, that's wild. Like, that, so that creates like a level of, so many people I've talked to on LinkedIn and in person and in group chats, is that I don't want to put myself in a position again of not, people not valuing what I bring to the table, the experience, perspective, the skill set, the degrees, that kind of stuff. I don't want to be treated as a line number on the budget. I don't want that. I want you to treat me with respect.
Absolutely.
Right? We're not a family, because that's not a thing. Don't tell me we're family. And then again, like I said, give me a pizza party and dangle, like, you know, we'll give you a half day voucher. I don't want that. I want you to treat me like an adult.
Yeah.
Treat me like I matter to the team and that bring value to what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Because people who don't feel valued will go someplace where they do feel valued.
100%. And they'll take a pay cut.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They'll take a pay cut. And I've done it. I'm going to go elsewhere, take a pay cut, because I actually feel like I'm wanted.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm, after a year of being there, like, oh, I'm actually comfortable here. Like, I can speak from experience. I can speak my mind. But so often, including my own life, is that people aren't allowed that space to actually do that.
Nope.
Right? Nope. It's sometimes the places I've worked, like the Ohio National Guard, but other places that they graduate from college, that's the first job, and they've been there their entire career. So they know nothing else, right? They know no other perspective. They don't even try to learn what else is out there, right? So I try to get to the point of, like, my perspective is never going to be your perspective. It's not. That's just not the way life is, right?
No.
But I think we can find some commonality and some common ground.
Yeah.
And I think if we allow each other the space to have a voice in the room, then all of us respect each other even more.
Absolutely. Markham, if you could leave our listeners with just one thing today, if you could leave our listeners with one ultimate piece of wisdom today, what would that be?
I'd say consistently understand who you really are at this point in your life. Right? Do an assessment, diagnostic, whatever it needs to be, and understand how the things that you're doing and saying and interacting with are affecting the things around you. Find that foundation, create a newer version of you. It's not a better version. It's a different version of yourself, right? And go forward with that and strengthen that version of it.
Yeah. I like it. Constantly reinvent yourself, constantly challenge yourself.
100%.
My final question for you today is, if people want to get in touch with you, purchase your book, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can go to my website, which I think you have the link, but I'll make sure you have the link. It's markhampfeiffer.com. That's obviously, it's first name, last name.com. That's for my free quizzes, 16 question quiz tied to my program, which also gets you my PDF. That's also free. Try to figure out the foundation of finding who you really are at this point. And then my book's on there as well.
And I'll make sure all of your contact information gets into the episode notes when our podcast, before our podcast goes live. Markham, thank you so much for a great conversation today. I truly enjoyed it. And I hope we can do it again in the future sometime.
100%, Dave. I like talking to you because we can talk about anything. And it just flows, and it's very comfortable and awesome.
Well, thank you. I feel the same way, you know, with you. It's just like two guys around a campfire having a conversation about life.
100%. Only thing missing is a barbecue and a beer.
There you go. Maybe we can do that virtually sometime, you know, just do that. So thank you again for a great conversation. Markham, I wish you well in the future, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Absolutely. And you have a great and wonderful day.
Thank you. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.